The House Judiciary Committee for Friday, May 4, 2007. We've got five Senate bills set for public hearing and possible work session, and we'll just take them in the order in which they are on the list. So I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 325.
Chair members of the committee, Senate Bill 325 comes to you at the request of the Oregon Law Commission. Allows an attorney for a parent or guardian to move to withdraw from dependency matter involving jurisdiction, establishing permanent guardianship, or terminating parental rights. The parent or guardian fails to appear at the hearing without reasonable explanation. Requires a person ordered to appear at court at dependency matter to personally appear. Prohibits a person from having his or her attorney appear instead unless the person ordered to appear is a child who is subject to the dependency matter. Allows court to grant exceptions. Requires the appropriate forms to contain a statement. The person must appear personally and cannot appear through an attorney.
Thank you, counsel. We have Wendy Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission here.
Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission, for the record. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 325. The bill passed the Senate unanimously and is a non-controversial bill that just clarifies some of our juvenile dependency jurisdiction, or not jurisdiction, but summons provisions. We did a rewrite in this area of law last session and made it much clearer what the requirements are for summons, what the requirements are once you're into court, and then those next steps along the way of how a dependency case moves along. And this bill cleans up three main points. I'm providing you with three different documents. One is a report from the Law Commission that was approved by the Commission in December before the bill was filed. It was written by a reporter that provides you the whole history of the issue and all the details. And then I have a one-page summary that just has the three main points. And then the Department of Justice was very involved with this project because dependency obviously is an important role for the Department of Justice to enforce those laws. And Carmen Brady Wright was unable to be here today, but I provided her written testimony for you in support of the bill. But just to explain what the three points of this bill are. First, it provides in statute clearly that you're required to personally appear. This is present law, but it's not explicit enough in the summons that a person gets. We want it even clearer that says you have to appear personally in court. And you can't rely on your counsel in a dependency, a permanent guardianship, or a termination of parental rights case. That's existing law. We want it clearer when a parent gets that summons that you need to personally appear. These are important matters you're dealing with, and it's not enough for the attorney to be there for you. I mean, it's about taking your children away from you, and so that has been existing law, and we want it even clearer in the statute. Secondly, the bill will reflect that there is an exception. For example, if a parent is in jail, an electronic telephone appearance is permitted, but you need to get permission before the hearing. You have to get an exception from the judge. And so the bill puts in the summons forms that an exception can be granted, but you have to get that in advance. And finally, present law, I'll speak mainly to the attorneys here. You all know that once you decide to represent a client, you have certain obligations with that client, and you're not supposed to withdraw if it would put that client in some sort of jeopardy. But for some reason, in juvenile court, judges are reluctant to grant a withdrawal because of all the rights associated with representing a parent, because there's that right to have representation. But the problem is there's an ethical duty to know what the client wants. And so if a parent never shows up and you don't know what the client wants, you can't really represent them. And so there's been this tug of war between the bench and the attorneys on trying to withdraw. And so this just puts in statute that, yes, you can move to withdraw. But again, it's up to the judge and the attorney to make that motion. And the judge has discretion. That's already in existing law in our lawyers' rules for disciplinary rules and ethical standards. But just putting it in the juvenile code, because many of these attorneys and judges only use the juvenile code to do their work. And so that's the first section of the bill. But again, it's a very discretionary provision. It's just making it clear that, yes, that right does exist in juvenile court as well. So those are the three highlights of the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Krieger.
One thing I realize a lot of these people who don't show up and are the same people that aren't responsible for their children, they have a lifestyle of not being responsible, it would seem that they would be the ones who most need representation. And so if this, what's the process then, because not being a lawyer, most of us here, if that attorney is allowed to withdraw, does the court assign an attorney, or what happens to them as far as are they brought in on charge, prepared to appear?
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, the way it works is if there is a motion to withdraw and the judge grants the withdrawal, it's just the case still moves along. And if the parent comes back into court, the court can reappoint counsel again. It could be the same counsel or a different counsel. But in these dependency and termination of parental rights and guardianship cases, the importance is to keep the case moving along. And if the parent is not there, statute already provides that the case can continue. This is just the relationship between the particular client and attorney, that there can be a withdrawal because there's an ethical obligation to represent the client's interest. And if you don't know what the interests are, you're ethically required to withdraw.
Go ahead. Just so I might know, what are the courts doing with these people when they don't appear? Are they getting a warrant out for them for failure to appear, or what's happening to them? If the law says they're to appear and they're not doing it, what's happening to them?
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, my understanding is that the case just continues. If they fail to, it's a summons to appear, and I'm not sure, I'm not aware of what the practice would, I don't know if there's any civil contempt or anything like that. It's a civil case, and so the case just continues without them. It could end up in a default judgment if the parents never show up.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Johnson, I think you know everything seems logical here. However, we're doing these things to be sure the person appears, and we're writing all these regs, and at the last paragraph we grant the court an exception. So why do we?
The last, Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, the last paragraph of which section?
Well, the last, the bolded on your page 9, and it's in the staff summary sheet, says allows the courts to grant exceptions. So,
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, I believe that's in reference to the exception of electronic appearance.
Only? Okay.
Right. It's personal appearance unless the court grants that permission, and it's not that you don't get to show up. It's that you know you could be in the hospital, the telephonic there, or
didn't read
it's
that
usually
the
hospital or jail.
Staff summary. I thought it's applying for the whole thing, not just or it's just applying to that part about it, the TV or something.
Judges can always grant exceptions. I mean, in the sense that what is mentioned, if someone were sick and unable to appear, and if you can present valid reasons for not appearing, I'm sure a judge will grant you an exception.
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, and Counsel Taylor, Section 9 of the bill is existing law, and it provides in sub 1 of Section 9 that that a judge can grant that exception if it complies with due process, but not limited to telephonic or other electronic means.
Ms. Johnson, with respect to the requirement of a personal appearance, what happens if, it's a parent whose rights are being terminated, and that person, because they're irresponsible, and maybe it connects with the reasons why the parental rights are being terminated, what if they just don't come? Will this be an obstacle to taking action that needs to be taken?
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, the present law already provides that the case moves along if the parent does not appear. This has to do with the notice that you are required to personally appear. The statute looks like it repeats itself so many times, but that's because there's the summons requirements, and then there's the once the person is in court, what you're supposed to notify them on the record, and then there's the summons form. So it's three different places, and then it's three different times for jurisdiction, termination of parental rights, and guardianship, those three different types of proceedings. So that's why it looks like it the same provision is repeated so many times.
Flores. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wendy, the third document you gave us, which is the letter from the Department of Justice, it does refer to the bill and explains that it's a clarification, but it references -1 amendments.
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, I was going to get to that. This bill actually passed the Senate so quickly that I frankly didn't have a chance to remind the committee to adopt these amendments. It's just making the same provision. It was missed one time by legislative council how to provide the exception in advance. It was missed in one of the types of forms. And I believe committee staff has that amendment.
Do we have dash one amendments? I don't have
my bill file. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is the first extension I've heard of amendments.
I apologize. I checked with committee staff.
Well, the only amendments we received from the Law Commission relate to Senate Bill 501.
I have them dated March 16th, but I have extra copies.
Didn't come through ours.
Ms. Johnson, if you, while we're having these passed out, maybe you could tell us again. I didn't quite absorb what the dash one amendment was doing.
Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, you'll see an explanation on the back page of the commission report on page 6. It just it's asking to just put the same, the statement must explain that DePere personally does not include a third student parent's attorney, and then adding a new section F that states the same thing, that if the court has granted a parent exception under the 419B918, that could happen as well, the electronic appearance. It's just one time it was missed, the same verbiage.
Okay, any further questions? Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, and I don't know if it's counsel or our witness. I have had students that do a self-emancipation because their parents really aren't in their life. Is this going to be part of that process that they, I don't know if this is pertinent or not.
Committee Representative, Representative Kopp, it's been a long time since I did this work,
uh-huh.
But I can tell you as a lawyer, when you're sitting there and you're there and your client's not, it puts you in an extremely difficult position of trying to represent your client when you can't consult with them. And my assumption is what this does is it gives the attorney the ability to withdraw from the case.
Okay.
Because there's really nothing you can do. You can't make a decision on behalf of your client because you can't consult with them. And that's my assumption for the underlying purpose of this bill.
Thank you.
Chair McPherson, Representative Kopp, I was also going to add that you'll see sometimes the reference to except for the child at issue.
Mm-hmm.
The folks that are supposed to be summoned are the parties, and the statute already requires that the children be summoned. The child can appear through counsel, and that's why there's that little
right.
Except if the person's a child at issue. But it's complicated because sometimes the child or minor is the parent, and so in those situations the minor should be summoned. So that's why the language about except if the person's a child at issue is written kind of technically, because sometimes the child should be summoned.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Then I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 325 and open a work session on Senate Bill 325.
Mr. Chairman, dash one's in the Senate Bill 325.
Representative Barker moves the dash one amendments in the Senate Bill 325. Any discussion? Any objection? The dash one amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 325 forward with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 325 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, the clerk call the roll.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative
Comp? Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisdom?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye. Senate Bill 325 as amended moves to the floor of the due pass. I think because it relates to dependency matters, I think this would be should have a little fuller explanation. Representative Comp?
Sure. I'd be happy to do it.
Terrific. Thank you very much. Okay, close the work session on Senate Bill 325 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 380.
Chair
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 388 comes to you from Senator Walker. It requires a school district to provide the Department of Human Services the teacher standards practices concerning other school district the records of investigation of suspected child abuse by former school employees as well as current school employees.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is a little fix-it to a bill you all passed last session. Last session it was Senate Bill 755, and it came about because of the high number of sex abuse, child abuse cases we've been hearing about in our schools. And I felt one of the ways – oh, Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7 – I felt one of the ways we could address it was to ensure that once a teacher had been convicted or school employee of such a crime, that parents or anyone else should be able to access the disciplinary records of that convicted individual to determine what the breakdown was in the school district. And Representative Flores knows all about this bill. We worked on it last session. Well, the funny thing was that a certain education service district on the South Coast decided that the bill wasn't explicit enough. When it says the records of a school employee, they said, well, we don't have to comply because that person is not a school employee anymore. Very funny. So someone had requested the records after the employee had been discharged, like all employees usually are under these circumstances, and the ESD refused to cough up the records. Well, that sort of sent me over the edge, because that was not the interpretation that should have been made. So we temporarily fixed that problem. I'm happy to report that this week the South Coast superintendent who refused to give up those records was booted from his job, but not without a golden parachute, and hopefully you'll be able to fix that when that's on the floor this week or next week. But anyway, what we have done is clarified that this is also applies to a former school employee. That's all it is. It's a simple little fix, so we are able to access those records. I would like to share with you a phone message I received from a board member at Clatsop Community in the Jewell School District, Ann Samuelson. She sent me she called earlier this session. She says, thank you for Senate Bill 755 from last session. It has had a huge impact on our local community and made it safer for a child to come to school. Thank you for being for children, for people, for good business, et cetera. So it has had an impact in school districts. Unfortunately, we do see some bad apples out there in our schools, school employees, school teachers. Unfortunately, they are everywhere in our society, the bad people. And so it's incumbent upon us to make sure that we keep the bad people away from our children, and this is one way to do it. So, any questions?
Representative Bonamici.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Senator Walker. On the page 2 of the bill, it talks about the disciplinary records of the employee. What's included in that? Is it everything that the teacher or employee has ever done, or is it just the record of criminal activity?
No, Mr. Chair and Representative Bonamici, it would be the entire disciplinary record of the employee, and that was necessary so that we would know how long this person had this person been disciplined before for other such actions, had anyone taken any interest in the reports that had been brought before, because in the Salem-Keizer district there were 4 students who were being sexually abused by a music teacher, and it had gone on for a long period of time, and for some reason no one seemed to do anything about it. Maybe they didn't know about it. I'm not sure how that was all resolved, other than I can tell you that I'm very proud of the actions the Salem-Keizer School District took in response to that. They invested a significant amount of money in training their employees. We have another bill in this building to provide training to the employees of school districts, but Salem-Keizer took it one step further, invested a great deal of money into that and ensuring that they would not have such a breakdown like that again.
Sure. Representative Krieger.
Yeah. As you're well aware, Senator, I'm pretty familiar with that issue down there, and I agree that those records should have been provided, but there's a lot more that was going on in that district, with the ESD director down there. And the golden parachute's $250-some thousand it's costing the district, and at the time they don't really have that money. Last week in the Brookings paper, there must have been a half a dozen to 8 letters on both sides of the issue very, very contentious issue down there, and the people involved I've known for 10, 15 years or longer. And so probably if the right actions would have been taken to start with, some of this could have been prevented.
Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, I agree with you, and I don't know if that's why this particular ESD has been given the boot, and the boot is what the newspaper headlines were. But I can tell you that it was that superintendent who gave us a great deal of grief and got lawyers involved, and we had to have an analysis of what that law meant. And for me, it just seemed disingenuous for a superintendent of an ESD to refuse to give over this information and try to find a way to get out of it. I mean, wasn't the intent. We're here to protect our children. We're here to have accountability to make sure we are protecting our children. And so we had to go to the Department of Ed and get some interim ruling so that we could make sure that the law was implemented the way it was intended. And so that's why you have this bill before you this session.
Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator, for being here today. On line 6 on page 2, it says to any person, and I thought this was just to Department of Human Services and a few other people. So if a former employee is convicted of these crimes, any person they have to release that information to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, you're exactly right. They are public records at that time. Any person, that means if you're just a John Doe, John Smith, living in Coos County, and you want to know why that teacher was doing what it was doing, he or she was doing, and why the district didn't do anything about it, you just go in and you ask for the records, and they have to give them to you. We have an incredibly permissive public records law in this state that we have a lot of exemptions. I have to tell you, I get very nervous when we craft one more exemption to the public records law. In fact, I think you will be hearing a bill in the next few weeks about public records. But yes, that's the intent, so that any individual in the state of Oregon can go to their school district and find out where was the breakdown, what happened. And this person's been convicted of a sexual crime, so I don't really see that should be troublesome to anyone.
Follow up, if I may. So the crime, the conviction of the crime is the trigger that allows any person to get the public records. It's not something that they can do at any time unless the trigger is the conviction of the crime.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, again, you are exactly correct. As line 4 states, the school employee has to be convicted of a crime listed in ORS 342.143. If you go to that statute, the list is lengthy. And we did that. And Representative Flores remembers this conversation. The teachers' union was very concerned that we would access disciplinary records of someone who had not been convicted of a crime, so you'd be going on a witch hunt. And we agreed that would be unfair, and so you had to be convicted before those records could be released. Because you have to remember, some people are accused of crimes and never convicted, and we are innocent until proven guilty.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Walker, thank you very much for this bill, and indeed it is the fix that needed to be provided, and also I was pretty sure just by the circumstance of the language that this was the South Coast issue that I also was kept apprised of it throughout the last interim. So thank you.
You're welcome, Ms. Chair and Representative Flores, and I appreciated your commitment and your work on this issue last session. We work very well together on these two issues. Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Connell.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Senator, I just have one clarification about the records to be released. As a principal, when something is divulged to you by a student, the first thing you do is take rigorous notes, including the time, date, and anything surrounding the event, much like a police officer does with an investigation. In fact, I personally believe they ought to give us one of those classes in administrative school. But in the records that are disclosed, are they the ones that come from the person's personnel file that is held in the district office, or are all the records with students' names and information that principals write in order to start an investigation? Is that, I just want to know what's the amount of detail in the records that are given.
Mr. Chair and Representative Comp, I'm trying, this bill is way from last session, and I haven't refreshed my entire memory from this file, but it seems to me that we also have a law that I passed last session that would redact the names of the children because they're under the age of 18. So they would, their names would be redacted, would be my understanding. If I'm incorrect, someone will correct me, I'm assuming.
Because that's my only concern.
Oh, I would say if that's not true, that would be fixed, but I'm almost certain that that is the case.
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Comp, Senator Walker, it's in the bill. It's in paragraph 7 on the second page.
Oh, well, there you go. Glad I read my own bill. Thank you.
Which line, please?
8 through 11 on the second page.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Further comment?
And that is from the bill last session, and that's unchanged.
Thank you very much for bringing this great bill forward to correct something that common sense should have taken care of, but we know that doesn't work in the law.
Well, you know, sometimes, Mr. Chair, we have to legislate common sense, and I hate to do that, but when it's necessary, we're not averse to doing so. So thank you.
And appreciate your keeping track of this and doing that.
You're welcome.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 380. Open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 380 to the floor if it do pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 380 to the floor if it do pass. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, call the roll, please.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Comp?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisner?
Aye.
Chair
Excuse. Motion carries. And who would like to carry the bill? Representative Krieger will carry the bill. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 501. Mr. Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 501 comes to you at the request of the Oregon Law Commission. Requires that the money award section of a judgment document include the amount of the money award separate from the interest owed payment of costs of disbursements or attorney's fees. Provides that the separate record maintained by the Circuit Court Administrator for Judgment be called the Judgment Lien Record. You also have the -1 amendments in front of you, which amend ORCP 47C by basically removing the terminology entering a judgment and basically replacing it with grant motion.
Thank you. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
You noticed that we had coffee brought in for us?
And then they took it out.
We've been waiting 4 months for the chair to do that, and none of us took advantage of it, and it's gone.
Mr. Nass and Mr. Watson? Is there coffee?
It was.
I think you delivered the wrong room. When they saw you sitting here, they immediately came in and pulled it back out.
Darn it. We had it last Friday.
Good morning. Please identify yourself and go ahead in any order you choose.
Good morning. Good morning, Vice Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Jerry Watson, special counsel to the Oregon Law Commission, and I'm happy to be here on behalf of SB 501 and the -1 amendment to it that you have before you. I think if it's all right with you, just provide a very quick introduction to what is essentially a very technical bill. And I believe that Mr. Nass has some additional comments he might wish to make. The bill itself simply does two things, as you can see from the sections of it. The first part of the bill deals with the money award issue and clarifies what is meant by money award. It's used in two different senses within the bill. This clarifies that at various points it would include amounts that are in addition to the base amount of the money award as initially entered by the court. The second part of the bill deals with what is called the separate record in amendments that were adopted to judgments back in 2003, eliminated the use of the word docket. This group decided that the separate record was a bit vague, it was an undefined term, and decided instead to advance the concept of judicial lien record. So it merely makes a substitution, appropriate substitution throughout the statutes to accomplish that. The third item is in the Dash 1 amendment that deals with Rule 47 and the matter of summary judgments. We have pulled forward those technical sections of another bill that we had proposed but has not proceeded because it was controversy on other matters. We've simply pulled forward the technical changes from that that clarify what you actually get when you get a summary judgment, which is, in effect, an order entering an order or a, you get the motion granted or you get the motion denied. And so we clarify that language in this amendment. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions. If you have any about these, we're...
Quick
question. On the summary judgment, it's not changing what happens. It's changing what it's called. Is that correct?
Vice Chair Barker, Representative Bonamici, members of the committee. It does not change what it is called in the sense that the name of summary judgment remains consistently used throughout. It changes the three, I think only three, very specific references. One, in one place it talks about granting the motion, in another denying the motion, and in a third prevailing on the issue. To deal with the concern that because of the various changes and clarifications, specifications of what a judgment amounts to that was adopted over the last several legislative sessions of a limited judgment, a general judgment, that there would be confusion when we talk about something called summary judgment, which in all cases does not actually result in a judgment, but depending upon what you've requested and what the matter before you is.
Thank you.
And if you would like further clarification, I believe Mr. Hendricks would be able to provide that.
Understood. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Nass.
Mr. Vice Chair, my name is Jim Nass. I serve as legal counsel for the Oregon Appellate Courts. Jerry said more succinctly than I would have, and so unless you have any questions, I won't say anything.
Any questions? Thank you.
Oh, Mr. Chair, the Dash 1 amendments, is there any comments on those? Am I looking at the right?
Yes, you are. But,
there's some Dash 1 amendments in front of us, and are those part of this discussion? Or
I had intended them to be a part of this discussion, and we are supportive of the Dash 1 amendments.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 501, and
open a work session.
Open a work session. Thank you,
Chair. I'll move the Dash 1 amendments into Senate Bill 501.
Representative Krieger moves the Dash 1s into Senate Bill 501. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
And, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 501 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 501 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Kong.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Motion carries. Committee, could this technical fix go on the consent calendar? Would that work?
Fine with me.
We'll do it, put on the consent calendar. Okay, and I'm going to skip 537. Mr. DeLashmet wanted to testify on that, and he's tied up right now, and he should be here shortly. So we'll move to Senate Bill 553. Open a public hearing on
Senate Bill 553 comes to you from the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. Approves adoption of amendments to sentencing guidelines by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission as a result of 2005 legislative session.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, committee. I'm Craig Prinz. I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. This bill comes before the legislature each session. It's the bill that needs to be approved to ratify the amendments to the guidelines that were made in light of the 2005 new felonies and amended felonies. So that's what this bill does. It each of the changes that were made in the guidelines that were basically responses to 2005 legislation are in here. You've got my short testimony, and you've got a list of each. This is probably the best way to look into this if you're interested. Sometimes this is one of those bills sometimes people aren't very interested in, frankly. This shows each rule that we're amending and tells you basically what it does and which bill it responded to. And then I did give you a copy of the amendments themselves. So, Mr. Chair, I can go through them or I can answer questions, whatever you prefer.
We could just go to questions, I believe. Any questions of Mr. Prinz? Yes.
Representative Krieger. This is amending rules.
Correct. Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, that's correct. The sentencing guidelines are kind of unique in that the sentencing guidelines have to be approved by the legislature. So they're almost like a statute. It's a rule that has to be ratified. And so when the statute says that when we respond to legislation, if there's a new crime, new felony crime, or a substantially amended felony crime, the Criminal Justice Commission sits down and basically categorizes it. If you remember the old grid, we would sit down and say, where does this fit on the grid? Is it between 1 and 11? How serious is this crime? And then we would also categorize it as whether it's a person felony or a non-person felony, a person misdemeanor. And so we did that after the 2005 session. And there weren't a lot of big bills, frankly, that went through the 2005 session other than I think the meth package was the main one. So we categorized those. Now the 07 legislature in Senate Bill 553 would approve those amendments. If you chose not to approve those amendments, they would basically sunset January 1, 2008, which means you'd have new crime. The crimes in 05 would not be categorized on the guidelines. So that's what it does.
Just a short. I don't know how it would work. If it was a Peter 11 stuff, statutory.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, they are statute. The Measure 11 is a statute passed by an initiative, but they also have a crime seriousness level also. So they are in the guidelines, but basically the guidelines are trumped by the statute.
Could any of these then actually become a Measure 11 because of where you categorize it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, no, because these are just rule amendments, nothing to Measure 11, which is a statute.
Thank you.
Mr. Taylor.
Members of the committee, Mr. Prince, my understanding, too, of Measure 11 versus sentencing guidelines, Measure 11 would set a floor of your sentencing guidelines by taking the crime seriousness plus the person's criminal history and the ability of the judge to depart upwards, you could actually give them a sentence longer than they otherwise would receive in Measure 11.
That's correct, Mr. Taylor and Mr. Chair. That's correct. Actually, Measure 11, if you, does have a mandatory minimum. If you look at an offender who has a serious criminal record, for some of the Measure 11 crime, there's not that much difference. However, under guidelines, they would be eligible for earned time. I guess that's a difference between the two. And then, of course, the judge can always depart upward from the presumptive sentence. So, on some occasions, the guidelines, the judge can actually give a longer sentence than Measure 11. That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Barker. Thank you, Mr. Prince. I just have a question. I understand that the notice for rulemaking goes out to lots of different people. And in practicality, does anybody come and participate in this, or is it more of a pro forma? We have to look at the legislation that was passed and make sure that we have the rules to implement it. Is it really a sort of a discussion?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, there is a real discussion of the commission, first of all. And the commission, I think, has a lot of different views. And then we typically don't have a lot of activity at the, the required rulemaking, notice of rulemaking. But what we did have this time is the defense attorneys come in, and I cooperate with them, and we work there. So it's a pretty small group of people, to be really honest, who are really interested in the sentencing guidelines. It basically is the criminal defense lawyers, the DAs, the judges. And so those folks are very, very much involved in the commission and do participate in the noticed rulemaking hearings.
Thank you.
Okay. No further questions. Thank you, Mr. Prince.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That closes the public hearing on Senate Bill 553. Open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 553 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves Senate Bill 553 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, call the roll, please.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Tom.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisdom.
Aye.
Motion carries. Representative Bonamici, would you carry that? I think because of the nature of the issue there, we should have an explanation on the floor.
I will do that.
Thank you. Thank you. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 537.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 537 comes to you at the request of the Oregon Council of Police Association. Adds police officer as defined by 801-395 to the list of eligible public employees at the request of the Department of Transportation substitute the person's work address instead of their residential address in their records.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brian DeLeishmet, representing the Oregon Council Police Associations. For those of you who have been around a long time and remember the old show, Name That Tune, I can name this tune in two notes or less, hopefully 2 minutes or less. This bill is a cleanup of a major faux pas that occurred last session. Last session, this statute was opened up to add some other body, and I think it was maybe OIA or somebody, into the ability to have to use a DMV as their address if they chose to do so for DMV records. Police officers historically have always been in the statute. Well, when LC redrafted the amendment to add the other folks in, they thought they would get cute and try and consolidate a whole bunch of areas. They looked at, if you look at page 2 on this, they looked at line 2 and said, a police officer appointed under ORS 276-021 through 023. They thought that included all police officers. It doesn't. That's Capitol Mall and Capitol Mall Security and Capitol State Capitol Police only. They then deleted the ability for any other police officer in the state to use this. This bill just goes back and says, okay, we're going to put them back in like they were before, and cleans it up. End of testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I can assure you that that's a popular bill with the police officers. It's easy for somebody to take your license number and get a registration, and then people that work in some bad areas would rather not have their being able to find their home address quite that easily, although, as we said before, with the computer, with secret anymore. But Okay. No further discussion. I'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 537.
I move Senate Bill 537 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 537 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Comp?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitson?
Aye.
Motion carries. Committee, on this one, it's again a technical fix. Should we just go ahead and consent calendar that and save a little time on the floor? If anybody has an objection, we can have it carry. Okay, on consent calendar. Thank you. Any no further business before the committee? We're adjourned.